2 Samuel 7:14-16. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men, and with the blows of the sons of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I removed from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever. So as we've seen over the last couple of weeks, this is the covenant with David, and this is a specific part of that in which God promises to preserve the sons of David. And it's remarkable, as we'll be looking this week at the conclusion of David's life, to see how it applies to David himself. The most prominent feature of the last part of 2 Samuel is the sad story of David's sin with Bathsheba, of his murder of Bathsheba's wife, Uriah. And the fact that the one to whom these promises were given would commit such sin is a striking and sobering fact. And yet, that's not the whole of the book. The whole of the book is past that, is largely concerned with the outworking of his sin, the consequences of it, the sword which does not depart from his house, as the Lord puts it. And I think you can see in that this chastening of the Lord in, that you read even in what we saw in 2 Samuel 7, that is, God's promise was not only to the son of David, but to David himself, that his mercy would not depart from him, but that he would chasten him. And the fact that David repented sets him apart from certainly his predecessor, Saul, who's mentioned here. And his attitude is a very different one. So I wanted to read that to maybe set the stage as we look at the, as I said, the most prominent feature of the last part of the book is this sin of David with Bathsheba. There are a couple of other things that I'll mention before we get there, two or three, just briefly. We looked a little bit at the context of the Davidic covenant in earlier weeks, and I noted that after this, in chapter 8, there are victories of David described over the surrounding nations. There's an emphasis that God had established David on his throne and given him peace, and there's confirmed in chapter 8 of 2 Samuel. Following that is a striking account in chapter 9 of his kindness to Jonathan. So you remember Jonathan was the son of Saul, and a striking contrast to his father. And David and Jonathan made a covenant together. Jonathan graciously acknowledged that the succession of the throne would not come to him, but to David. And David and he swore together. And one of the promises was that David would show kindness to Jonathan's descendants. And so that's fulfilled in a remarkable way by David in chapter 9, where there's this fellow Mephibosheth. His name is, you don't want to say several times in a row too quickly. But Mephibosheth is a son of Jonathan, whom David actually seeks out and seeks to honor him. And he describes himself in verse 8 as a dead dog. He was probably considered himself dead in more than one way. His line, in terms of the inheritance of the kingship, had been cut off. And he was also crippled. And this is a remarkable example of David's kindness, as well as a picture of God's own working. The Psalms emphasize this fact that God makes the lowly to rise and puts them in high places. And here's an example in a human sense of David raising up Mephibosheth from obscurity and from possible opposition of the king and honoring him so that Mephibosheth sits at the king's table. Now, he comes back into the story later on, but just the account of Mephibosheth given in chapter 9 is a remarkable one. Chapter 10 talks about the defeat of the Ammonites. There's more to the story there. There's some humiliation of David's men who were sent there, and David, in the end, shows his military power by the hand of the Lord and conquers. But as I said, I really want to focus today, so we got down to chapter 11, on the sad description, and I'll read the opening verses of chapter 11, 2 Samuel. It happened in the spring of the year, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him, and all Israel. And they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. Then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful to behold. So David sent and inquired about the woman. Someone said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Then David sent messengers and took her. And she came to him, and he lay with her, for she was cleansed from her impurity. And she returned to her house. And the woman conceived. So she sent and told David and said, "I am with child." And then the sad account that follows of David sending to Joab, his military commander, and commanding Joab to expose Uriah, the husband of Bathsheba, to death in the midst of battle. Now, this is a familiar story, and I want to reflect a little bit as we go through on some of the outworking of it. But we should note from the larger context some information about Uriah, for example. Uriah was not an unknown to David. He's listed at the end of the book in 2 Samuel 23 as one of the 30, one of the top guys, one of the top warriors for David. And there's even some thought that Eliam, who's mentioned here as the father of Bathsheba, was also among the 30. There is an Eliam listed in that same chapter, chapter 23, verse 34. So it could be that David not only knew Uriah, but also knew his father-in-law. And that would only magnify the greatness of the sin in which he took Bathsheba from Uriah for himself. Of course, it's wasn't where he was supposed to be. It was the time, and as it mentions in verse 11, when the kings go out to battle. And there seems to be a deliberate notice of that in the account, that David remained in Jerusalem. And there are many more things that could be described in terms of the occasion of sin that was allowed there. But I'd like to skip over perhaps some more of the description of what actually happened to Uriah and how he was killed in battle to the end of chapter 11. So let's skip over to verse 26. I'm assuming familiarity with the story, and I want to reflect a little bit on the meaning and on the consequences of it. Chapter 11, verse 26. When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. And when her mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house. She became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. And then that is worked out in the next chapter. God's displeasure is shown. And yet, as I said, in a sense also God's mercy, because God does not abandon David, but chastens him instead. And so, chapter 12, verse 1, then the Lord sent Nathan to David. And he came to him and said to him, "There were two men in one city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceedingly many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he had bought and nourished. And it grew up together with him and with his children. It ate of his own food and drank from his own cup and lay in his bosom. And it was like a daughter to him. And a traveler came to the rich man, who refused to take from his own flock and from his own herd to prepare one for the wayfaring man who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him." So David's anger was greatly aroused against the man, and he said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die, and he shall restore fourfold for the lamb because he did this thing, and because he had no pity." Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your keeping, and gave you the house of Israel and Judah. If that had been too little, I also would have given you much more. Why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? You have killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me, and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up adversity against you from your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this son. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel, before the sun. So David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord also has put away your sin. You shall not die. However, because by this deed you have given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also who is born to you shall surely die. And the account goes on to describe the death of that child and David's the sickness and David's reaction to that and the ultimate death of the child. Now, there are several notable things in the account. One is the fact that Nathan, who has been mentioned before as a prophet, he was the one by whom the covenant of David was delivered, should come to the king at all. This is a remarkable thing which we should not overlook. That is, in God's economy, there were men who could rebuke a king. And that's a great thing to have when a king goes astray. His authority was not so absolute that God would refuse to send someone to rebuke him. So there are kings in the later history of Great Britain who thought no one could rebuke them, but that was not the case with David and with his kingdom. There are also striking things about the way the sin is described. You notice in verse 9 it says, you have killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. Now, David was a long ways away from the battlefield when it happened, and yet the sin is directly ascribed to him. You have killed. And of course, even at the end of the verse, there's an indication of the means, with the sword of the people of Ammon. And yet, he himself is responsible for the sin he has committed, and even for the death of Uriah, because he was the one who had ordered it. Now, the description that the sword will never depart from your house is worked out later, and even the specific detail of the violation of the wives of David, and we'll come to that in the chapters that follow. But I think we ought to note at least two other things. You could spend a long time just on this one passage, but let me note at least two other things. And that is the contrast with Saul, which was already mentioned in 2 Samuel 7, that God would preserve him, is very clear in David's reaction to the rebuke. And he says, and in the English it's a very short response, I'm sure it's the same way in the Hebrew, I have sinned against the Lord. That's his response to the rebuke. We were talking about this at lunch in the Chuck was pointing out how many words Saul gave when he was rebuked. And they weren't even to this effect, I have sinned against the Lord. He multiplied excuses and so on. But David's heart is a very different one. He has sinned, certainly, and the sin should not be minimized. And it's gone on for a while, right? Bathsheba has already conceived and given birth to the child. So it hasn't been a short time. And yet at the rebuke of the Lord, David confesses his sin. And Psalm 51 is if you look at the title of Psalm 51, you'll see that the psalm is written on the occasion of this repentance from the sin. And it spells out further David's response to it. And it's striking there that David in that confession says, against you only have I sinned. He's speaking to God. Now, that doesn't contradict Uriah could well have had a claim that you sinned against me, and there are lots of people against whom David sinned. Yet David acknowledged that, in the ultimate sense, his sin was directly against God. And that, I think, is supported also by the idea in verse 14 that by his sin he had given occasion of the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. He was the man after God's own heart, and the king who was to be unlike Saul, and not to be like the kings of the nations around him, but he acted just like the kings of the nations around him. He took whatever woman they wanted for themselves and dispatched any, or disposed of, however you want to say it, anything that got in their way, or anyone that got in their way. So it was a terrible sin. It was an occasion for the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. And still the response of David, his confession of sin, is a clear indication of his heart before God. Now, one of the things I'd like to notice is toward the end of the chapter. If you look over in chapter, verse 24 of the same chapter, chapter 12, the son whom Bathsheba had borne died, and then it says in verse 24, then David comforted Bathsheba his wife and went into her and lay with her. So she bore a son, and he called his name Solomon. Now the Lord loved him, and he sent word by the hand of Nathan the prophet. So he called his name Jedidiah, because of the Lord. Jedidiah means beloved of the Lord. Of course, Solomon was the one who inherited the throne and who built the temple, an immediate fulfillment of the promises in 2 Samuel 7. And again, it's a striking evidence of God's mercy that it was by Bathsheba that this son who succeeded David was born. And the Lord, it says even specifically, the Lord gave him another name, beloved of the Lord. That being the case, it's still sin has its consequences, and the destruction that is described in David's family and in the nation is a serious one. That goes from chapter 13 through chapter 20 and beyond. So you can just think about what a chunk of the rest of the book is taken up with what is in various places directly connected with the sin of David. So I'd like to take some time to think about those consequences. The summary is not a happy one. In chapter 13, Tamar, who is a daughter of David, is raped by her brother, Amnon. Now, it's not her, I guess it would be her half-brother. The eldest son of David is Amnon. Amnon, in turn, is murdered by the actual brother, apparently, of Tamar, who is Absalom. Absalom is the third oldest son. Absalom later leads a rebellion against David and is killed in the rebellion. In the midst of the rebellion, David's concubines are taken, and in fulfillment of what we read, in full sight of the people, are violated by Absalom. And if that's not enough, later on there's this fellow Sheba, who's not one of David's family, but a Benjamite who rebels against David. That's not everything, but that's enough for us to think about in terms of the consequence and the sword not departing from the house of David. But I'd like to think through some specific points in this. The first thing to notice is a very sad fact about David, both as a father and as a king. As I said, the violation of Tamar is described in chapter 13, and I'd like you to note verse 21 of chapter 13. There's so much in all this, I'm going to have to not read a lot of the specific parts of the account. But it says in chapter 13, verse 21, but when King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. Now, sure, I mean, I'd be very angry too, but it's so that's good as far as it goes. But as you read through it, you see that although Absalom takes this into his own hands, yet even David seemed to be unwilling or unable to discipline Amnon, and the same thing applied to Absalom also. This is the sort of thing that we saw with Eli, whose sons not only committed what you might say is a private sin, but were in a blatant way violating the law of God. And yet, as king, David seemed unwilling to exercise the discipline he should have. However, in the midst of all this, you get the sense, as I said, that this is not merely the just random events, but the outworking of God's determined will. So, I already read chapter 12, verses 11 and 12 about the wives of David. Let's turn over to chapter 16. Verses 21 and 22. So I'm skipping over some ground here, but this is in the midst of the rebellion of Absalom. And Ahithophel gives this counsel. I'll come back to Ahithophel in just a minute, but let's focus on what the counsel is and the fulfillment of it. As David has left the city and left his palace, but left the concubines behind, Ahithophel said to Absalom, this is David's son and the one who has rebelled against David and apparently seized power, has seized power to all effect, go in to your father's concubines whom he has left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you are abhorred by your father. Then the hands of all who are with you will be strong. So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the top of the house, and Absalom went in to his father's concubines in the house of all Israel. Now, that fulfillment of the judgment that came on him shows that even the wicked acts of men in history are a working out of God's purpose. That doesn't, of course, make it right. That doesn't approve of what Absalom does, but it emphasizes what you see again and again in the history of God's people, and that is that God works out his purpose, and in the end it is for their good. One other thing I'd note in connection with that and along those lines is as David is fleeing, he hears, well, let's turn back to chapter 15, verse 31. David is fleeing from the city, and it says in chapter 15, verse 31, when someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, I pray, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Ahithophel was one of David's counselors. In fact, if I had read the next verse from chapter 16, he was, it says there, the advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one had inquired of the oracle of God. Well, this is an important counselor of David. And this could be a serious blow to David. Yet it's striking the way David prays here, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness, and of course the way it's fulfilled. Ahithophel wasn't a renowned counselor much longer because he killed himself. In fulfillment of David's prayer, again, you can see it spelled out in, later on in chapter 17, verse 14. So Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the advice of Hushai the Archite is better than the advice of Ahithophel. For the Lord had purposed to defeat the good advice of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring disaster on Absalom. So you see, again, the outworking of God's purpose. In this case, David's prayer was part of that. And this wise man, in a sense, a man renowned for his wisdom, although his rebellion against David was foolish, his counsel was frustrated. I would add, not only is this a good example of God's work in history, but it's a good model for our own prayers. It's a good thing to pray that the counsel of men who scheme against the Lord would be frustrated. Sometimes we feel that we ourselves are not able to counter the power they have, but God is always able to frustrate the plans of the wicked. And in fact, you might say that's the business he's in. Psalm 33 talks about that sort of thing. It's the purpose of the Lord that shall stand. Okay, so I'm trying to draw out some of the lessons from what goes on here, and I'd like to bring out one more, and then I'll give you a chance to bring out some. There's a lot that could be noted here. But that is toward the end of the account. It's actually brackets. So let's look at the first part. This is back in chapter 16. We'll read that first. David is fleeing the city, and there's this fellow, Shimei, and we talked about at lunch on Tuesday also. Now, when King David came to Bahurim, there was a man from the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, coming from there. He came out cursing continuously as he came, and he threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David, and all the people, and all the mighty men who were on his right hand and on his left. Also Shimei said thus when he cursed, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. The Lord has brought upon you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. The Lord has delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom, your son. So now you are caught in your own evil, because you are a bloodthirsty man. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Please, let me go over and take off his head." But the king said, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? So let him curse, because the Lord has said to him, 'Curse David.' Who then shall say, 'What have you done? Why have you done so?'" So David said to Abishai and all his servants, "See how my son, who came from my own body, seeks my life. How much more may this Benjamite? Let him alone, and let him curse, for so the Lord has ordered him. It may be that the Lord will look on my affliction, and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing this day." And as David and his men went along the road, Shimei went along the hillside opposite him, and cursed as he went, threw stones at him, and kicked up dust. Now, this is a remarkable action by this Shimei, who should have known that he could have lost his head very easily. It wasn't as if David had no military might with him at all. But the response of David shows, I think, his own understanding of his situation, and that this is the outworking of God's, this is God's chastising hand, I'll say it that way, on David. And so instead of returning a curse, instead of laying a hand on Shimei, he shows mercy to him and instead wishes that the Lord will repay the good for cursing. Now, it's not just David's weakness. It's a striking thing. This Shimei, in a sense, brackets the story. If you flip over to after the death of Absalom, and David's returning to power, that's in chapter 19, and look at verses 16 and following. David is coming back. Absalom has been killed, which was a great grief to David. And David's grief was something of a grief to the people, to the army. It says, "And Shimei the son of Gera, a Benjamite who was from Bahurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him. And they went over the Jordan before the king. Then a ferry boat went across to carry over the king's household and to do what he thought good. Now Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king when he had crossed the Jordan. Then he said to the king, 'Do not let my lord impute iniquity to me, or remember what wrong your servant did on the day that my lord the king left Jerusalem, that the king should take it to heart. For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. Therefore here I am, the first to come today of all the house of Joseph, to go down to meet my lord the king.' But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, 'Shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed?' And David said, 'What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah, that you should be adversaries to me today? Shall any man be put to death today in Israel? For do I not know that today I am king over Israel?' Therefore the king said to Shimei, 'You shall not die.' And the king swore to him." Now, David has full power here, and considering the situation, certainly David could have put Shimei to death. He had the power to do so. And yet, still he shows mercy to him. I want to emphasize this fact because I plan after this to look at the Psalms briefly, that is, after we finish 2 Samuel, I want to take a few weeks to work in some sort of survey of the Psalms. This is again an indication of what sort of man it is who prays in the Psalms for God to judge his enemies. This is a man who will not take judgment into his own hands and instead commits himself to the keeping of God. Now, he does pray that the curses of this man will be turned into blessings. So it's not as if he has no, is one of these people who doesn't care what happens to him, It's not that at all. He acknowledges his own sufferings as a result of his own sins. And in the place of that, he commits himself into God's hands and prays that God would deliver him from his enemies. The story wouldn't be complete if I didn't mention one other thing, however, and that is David knew that this Shimei was still a threat to his kingdom. And I suppose the fact that he could come down with 1,000 men would be some indication of that. So I would be remiss if I didn't note that in 1 Kings chapter 2, among the parting words to his son Solomon is, in effect, make sure you take care of Shimei. And Solomon, in his wisdom, confines Shimei to the vicinity of Jerusalem, and when it's violated, Shimei is put to death. So David was a wise man. He understood that Shimei could be a threat to his own son's kingdom. And maybe I should, to note that, since I may not come back to it, not to give you the wrong impression as if David was saying, well, I won't kill you, but my son will. It's pretty clear in the context that it has to do with the establishment of the kingdom. And so I'll read 1 Kings 2. This is the word of Solomon to Shimei upon his upon the word that Shimei is to die. 1 Kings 2:45, that King Solomon shall be blessed, and the throne of David shall be established before the Lord forever. So the king commanded Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he went out and struck him down, and he died. Thus the kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon. So David understood the necessity for preserving the succession, and that a man like this could be a threat against him. David did not kill him, nor did Solomon just execute him directly, but Solomon limited his ability to gather a rebellion against him, and when that was violated, Shimei was put to death. Okay, there's more in 2 Samuel that I want to talk about. The Gibeonites and the interesting story there and the conclusion of the book. But do you have any comments so far just on the sin of David and the outworking of it? There's a lot more that could be said, so if you'd like to fill in the big gaps I've left, the numerous gaps I've left, feel free to. Looked like David was going to say something. No? Okay.
I've often thought about Bathsheba as a woman. Bathsheba's fault, that she really was not protecting herself either, and she could have refused the king. It might have meant her life, but she could have said no and be.
Yeah, there's not much explicit description because the focus is on this, the king, but that could well be the case. Yeah.
Might not be why the succession to Jesus Christ went through a different son.
It might be. Yeah. If you look in the genealogies, it's not Solomon who's listed there. Well, Bathsheba is, it's a little complicated.
I was thinking, though, as you're talking about the trouble that David did have with his sons, a number of very critical times in Scripture where a man's sons have done something that have caused a significant direction and change, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse, and you can see how a good son, such as Jonathan, Saul, aids his father and aligns himself with the purposes of God, and yet the sons of Eli are a disgrace and cause the people to sin because of their treachery. Here, David, I don't know if he had multiplied wives or just couldn't keep track of his kids, and whether no matter what his problem was, he seems to have excelled in so many areas, but in this one area, he couldn't bring his kids up in this mission.
Yeah, you mentioned the multiplying wives. It's interesting in that connection as one of the many downsides of polygamy. I mean, polygamy is against God's law from the beginning, but there are lots of practical reasons why it's a downer. And the fact that there were these two who were, namely Tamar and Amnon, who lived in the same household but weren't actually brother and sister, that's another aspect of the same thing. Yeah, I didn't read at the beginning, but 2 Samuel chapter 3 gives the order that I gave of the sons. And it's just amazing to see how many wives David had, and the sons are listed there. It is the sort of thing that Samuel warned the people that the king would do. And it was common practice. That doesn't justify it. So in a sense, David didn't stand out from the others by that. Solomon, his son, if anyone, stood out for the practice of polygamy.
But as a husband and father, isn't that passing down a godly heritage the most important thing you do as a father?
Sure. Yeah,
he excelled in everything except that one.
Yeah.
And it seems, the prophets seem to be a hard thing for them. Maybe they were too busy with their work.
Yeah, it's a striking thing that right after the institution of the Abrahamic covenant, the Lord says, "I will bring these things about," and directly connects it with Abraham teaching his children in the ways of the Lord. And that, as Dave was just pointing out, you can see both the good and the bad when that happened and when it didn't happen, the effects of that. So, well, Jeff had his hand up first, but if you want to follow up on what was just said, I guess.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Well, I just looked at Matthew.
The account in Luke gives a different way of reckoning the genealogy.
And the son Nathan.
The son who's mentioned there is not Solomon. So, exactly how the accounts... Yeah, yes, there is a controversy in terms of figuring out how the two accounts are related. And I'm sure whoever teaches that part of the New Testament survey, a decade from now, will clarify that. There may be a legal versus,
The line...
One Mary, one Joseph.
Right.
Yeah, Joseph's line went through Solomon. Mary's line went through Nathan.
So in terms of a legal reckoning, Solomon was the ancestor of Christ as the father.
Not really, because, if Mary received the Holy Spirit, her line was down through the line of Nathan, and really Solomon's line had nothing to do with the ultimate kingship or the birth of Christ. It was Joseph who was her earthly husband, and if you're just a person, as a normal person back then, you see Joseph and you see Mary. Well, they're both the lineage of David. That's the way I would.
Rob,
I would just like to point out the fact that David said he shall surely die. But then the interpretation of that was he'll give fourfold as the law said.
Uh-huh.
As the law prescribed, he would have to pay back fourfold. And in the judgment of David, the law was fulfilled in that he had to give four of his sons five, as the four never departed from his house.
That's a good point. Okay, good. Let me make a few comments on the remainder of the book. There are some interesting passages, and some which require some work for a careful interpretation that I'm not going to dwell on. One example immediately follows what we were talking about. This is the Gibeonites, whom Jeff told us about, and the deception that they worked in, the protection that they were promised. Apparently Saul had violated that, and so there's a description here of the famine that came on the land because of that, and what was done to atone for the sins. There's also a description of the success of David in later years in battle, and a mention of four giants who were killed toward the end of chapter 21. Chapter 22 is more or less Psalm 18, and I may come back to that as we think a little bit about the Psalms and how understanding them in terms of the life of David is important. Chapter 22 speaks of David is speaking the words of this song on the day when the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. And so the account that follows is more of the passage that follows is more or less Psalm 18. Chapter 23 contains the last oracle of David. And again, it's something I want to come back to because it sets a good tone for thinking about the Psalms. But let me turn, and the last part of chapter 23 is the description of these of the three mighty men and then of the 30. And I'd already mentioned the connection with Uriah, for example, at the end of chapter 23, being among the mighty men. The conclusion of the book is in the numbering of the people. Now, there's a parallel account of this in 1 Chronicles chapter 21, in which the initial statement adds more information. It says, "Now Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel." 2 Samuel 24:1 says, "Again, the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel, and he moved David against them to say, 'Go number Israel and Judah.'" Now, those are not contradictory accounts because Satan, although unwillingly, ultimately accomplishes the purpose of God. And yet, this gives us information about the occasion of the sin. The anger of the Lord is aroused against Israel, and specifically David is moved to number them. Now, this is not a good thing. Okay, it's clear from the account that it's not a good thing. It's even strikingly clear to Joab. I don't think I would put Joab forth as the most perceptive moral person in this chapter. It's an understatement. Okay, but even Joab says in verse 2, the king says to Joab to do this, and Joab says in verse 3, "And now may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times more than they are. And may the eyes of my Lord the king see it." But why does my Lord the king desire this thing? So if you ask what was wrong here, and you look in the commentaries, you'll find lots of reasons as well as a lot of uncertainty. It's pretty clear that there's something wrong in the attitude and motivation of David. Yet, the response of Joab makes it clear that it's something, if it's just that, it's still something that Joab can see. And it may be that it's connected with disbelief in the promises given, especially to Abraham, the numbering thereby being some doubt on the part of the king that he has the might to do what he wants to do. That may be implicit in what Joab says, and although I don't have time to develop it now, if you look in 1 Chronicles chapter 27, there seems to be an allusion back to the same account. And it says, "But David did not take the number of those 20 years old and under, because the Lord had said he would multiply Israel like the stars of the heavens. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, began a census, but he did not finish, for wrath came upon Israel because of this census. Nor was the number recorded in the account of the Chronicles of King David." So one possibility would be that David was seeking to actually take a census of those under 20 that he might add to the military beyond what he was allowed to do in the law. That's pretty speculative. In any case, what seems to underlie David's attitude is distrust in God's promise and arrogance. After having seen God's hand deliver him through so many battles, there seemed to have been some doubt on his part that God could provide for him. The census is not completed, as it's indicated in 1 Chronicles and even in chapter 27, as I read there. And even here, it says there's some description, but they don't actually complete the census. And David, in verses 10 and following, realizes the sin that he has done. And another prophet, Gad, comes to him. Instead of Nathan, it's Gad in this case. And interestingly enough, David is allowed to choose his own punishment. In this case, there had already been mention of famine before and warfare, and this the pestilence or the plague that comes is what David chooses. Let me conclude just by saying something about the significance of this in terms of the conclusion of the book. It could be that this actually occurred earlier in the life of David, but whether it does or whether this is the right historical location, the important thing to notice is the connection with what follows in First Kings. And that is the site at which the plague is stopped is on the threshing floor of this Arunah. Now, this fellow was a Jebusite. Okay, this is another occasion for the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, except apparently this enemy had become a friend, seemed to be a worshiper of the true God. So this Arunah is willing to give the threshing floor to David, the place where the angel has been seen and the plague stops. David insists that he will buy it, and actually, if you look at the numbers, he paid a fair amount for it. It wasn't bought cheap, as we would say. But what's significant here is that this is the site on which the temple is built. And so I didn't put up the reference, but in 2 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 1, this is Mount Moriah. This is the place where David specifically directs Solomon, by the inspiration of the Spirit, that the temple will be built. So you see, the provision of mercy here, the offering which is to stay the hand of the slaying angel, is then in preparation for the provision of the regular sacrifice, and of course, looking forward to the coming of Christ. One could draw various conclusions about the seeming infatuation of modern American churchmen to count. Is there a disbelief in the promise of God that he will multiply his church? And the same sort of desire always to be figuring out how many people there are. I don't know. I'm a mathematician and I like numbers, but I think sometimes people apply the social sciences in ways they shouldn't. And a kind of a unbelief can creep in when we focus so much on growth, perhaps the same way David did. I know that's a provocative thing to say when there's not much time left, but if in fact that was the sin of David, if it had to do with his doubt and the promise that Abraham's seed would be as the sand on the seashore, then we should examine ourselves and see if we really believe the promise of God. Again, that's a lot thrown at the end, but at least nominally I finished 2 Samuel today. Any comments or questions?
It's striking sort of seeing God working through David's life. And of course, we see much evidence of faith in the Psalms. You know, this guy, he's really sticking to God. And you really see him finishing strong. You have to say, although Solomon is yet going to take up the throne, of course, that's not going to be the thing that you discuss right now. But he's not going to necessarily, he doesn't obviously begin extremely strong. I mean, he still does some offered on the high places that's going on, but he definitely doesn't end strong.
Uh-huh.
You know, we see Solomon being rich and very wise, but maybe not the same sort of fruit in his life. You know, it's interesting to see this man, a man after God's own heart, is far from perfect. I mean, here again, you know, we have I have sinned and greatly, I have acted foolishly. You know, this is, you want to say, not necessarily, it's kind of a recurring theme. I mean, it's not something that completely goes away. I guess that even take heart in this. You know, really seeking when we interact with the Psalms, we want to reflect that same sort of God be at work in me. Don't take my Holy Spirit from me, you know. Don't keep up. Yeah. I'm not done. You know, and you're not finished with me.
Yeah, that,
encouraging to me.
That is encouraging. And I think the Psalms, and I want to develop this idea, bring out the same aspect that that there's a battle to be fought. And David was a warrior in the physical sense, but he also knew the battle of the heart. And the danger of the perfectionist who says, you know, I can reach a state where sin doesn't touch me anymore, the danger of that is really extremely great. And it may well lead to a denial that I have sinned. But David knew when he had sinned, and he knew that he had to be he had to be on his guard, and he knew he had to acknowledge his sin when he did sin, and that the battle wasn't over. Rob.
It's been too long since I've read about this, but was there some provision in the law about taking a census and how it was done?
Yeah, see, I skipped over all this, didn't I? There were it seems like censuses were taken at the specific command of God,
okay.
And they were to collect a fee in connection with some of the censuses.
Blood money.
Right. And right. So they were closely regulated, I guess you could say it that way. And there were censuses taken before they entered the Promised Land and after they entered the Promised Land. So some commentators take the approach that he was not directed to do it and therefore he shouldn't have done it. It's not clear exactly how to understand it. But yeah, that's right. It was regulated, and there were specific things the census was not allowed to count. Yeah, people that were not allowed to count, and the Levites were an example of that. Right. If you read, you know, various commentators, you find lots of very speculation about, you know, whether David was just trying to get more money for his treasury so he could fight a battle, or whether he's trying to get more men in his army so he could fight a battle, or what. But in any case, I think the fact that the censuses were regulated is an important feature. I appreciate you pointing that out.
I'm a little bit unclear about it. In 2 Samuel, it describes that he's been given a sum, a particular number is mentioned. You're saying that in other passages it appears like an incomplete number?
They give the number, but it's not. Yeah. So this wasn't real fair. They give a number, but it's said that this is not everyone. And let me see if I can.
The thing that I guess I really would emphasize, this has been 9 months, it says in the Second Samuel passage. It's not like it happened sort of impulsively, and it, you know, it's not like road rage, you know, it's over and done, you know. It's been 9 months.
Yeah.
This
right.
Over which this took place.
Right.
It's time for all of them.
Yeah.
That's kind of striking.
Yeah, the passage that I had in mind was 1 Chronicles 21:6, and this actually goes back to what Rob said also. Referring to Joab, it says, "But he, Joab, did not count Levi and Benjamin among them, for the king's word was abominable to Joab." So, you know, everyone who has people working for him know how they can drag their heels, and this is a good case of what he says. You can tell me to do it, but I'm not going to do it the way you want me to. So he refused to actually finish the count. That's what I had in mind. I mean, it's, yeah. It sounds like we should stop. So.